delight to be sharing together once again in this series entitled The Biblical Roots of the Middle East Crisis. And as we explore this topic together, certainly it's one that seems to be on our hearts and imaginations and thoughts these days in a significant kind of way. And perhaps the Middle East has been that way for us for quite some time, but it waxes and wanes in my estimation over the course of time. In some periods of time, it has been more or less on our minds. This is one of those times in which it is obviously more on our minds ever since the events back in October. And that's what sort of had led me to want to explore this once again. I've addressed this subject on a couple of prior occasions, both here and in my prior church. But this is one of those times in which we ought to think about what God is up to during this time. Last week, we started the series by looking at sort of a biblical foundation. What is it that the Bible actually says about this land that is called Israel or Palestine or Israel-Palestine, whichever you prefer? What does the Bible say about that land, and what promises were made by God to the people of Israel about it? And then what conditions did God place upon his people who would occupy that land? And we got ourselves, I think, off to a good start biblically. Tonight what I'd like us to do is to lay sort of a geographical foundation, try to understand what the land is really like and what some of the issues are. It occurs to me as I sort of have been thinking about this that this is an extraordinary time, but I think most of us might regard a lot of our experiences as having taken place during an extraordinary time. For those of you who may either be in this room or maybe watching on television who are a bit on the older side, maybe the World War II and the aftermath of World War II was an extraordinary time. You can't imagine the world apart from those events. I grew up in the early part of the Cold War. My father was involved in World War II, but in elementary school, some of my earliest memories are hiding under desks to make sure that we weren't killed by a nuclear holocaust. Seems kind of silly now, but you perhaps remember those kinds of times. I remember those drills. As a child, of course, didn't really have any idea about the nature of the danger. At the same time, I was a teenager and a young adult during most of the Vietnam War era. Many of you perhaps participated in one way or another in that period of time. That was one of, at least it's understood, as one of the great quagmires in American history. Probably never since the Civil War has our country been so divided. And then, of course, we find ourselves in a quite divisive occasion even now. But the legacy of Vietnam continues to leave its mark on governmental decisions, because anytime we have a prospect of doing anything militarily overseas, we wonder whether we're getting ourselves into another quagmire. And so that puts the brakes on a lot of things that we might have done at one point in time. We have recently finished operations in Iraq, and we have left Afghanistan in a manner that has been highly controversial. Our motivation to get those troops home is so that we would once again not get involved in another one of those international quagmires, and I think that's part of the Vietnam legacy. But this time is also extraordinary for other reasons. Some of us look back about 23 years ago with the whole experience of 9/11. That was what got our attention riveted back toward the Middle East. At that particular time, the attack on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon, and then the plane crash in Shanksville, Pennsylvania, an attack which was launched within our own borders, but it was an attack by Al-Qaeda, an Islamic terrorist organization, and those who did that attack originated in the Middle East. And that was an extraordinary time as well, because we were no longer so much concerned with a nuclear holocaust. We weren't one of two superpowers, which during the Cold War was seen as sort of a mutually assured destruction that prevented nuclear war. Instead, we were the only superpower, but we found ourselves very vulnerable. Vulnerable to an insidious danger, vulnerable to an attack by terrorist cells who were all over the world, terrorists who would willingly die for their cause, terrorists whose religion gave them the psychological foundations and even from their perspective the moral imperative for their sacrifice. And that led us, of course, on that occasion, to going back into the Middle East and fighting over there. We focused our attack, interestingly enough, on Iraq, although that wasn't necessarily the focal point of where all of these things originated, but that's where we ended up. There are other reasons why this is an extraordinary time, especially if you're a Christian. The Middle East contains a land that is called Palestine as well, and it's an anglicized name based on the biblical name Philistines, a people who populated the coastal regions of the eastern Mediterranean Sea. And so this place that we call Palestine is the location of the modern state of Israel, which was restored as a functioning nation in 1948 after more than 2,000 years of exclusion from the land of the Jewish people. It was the site of the return of hundreds of thousands of Jews whose families had been dispersed all over the world in their intervening millennia. And this was a return which was sanctioned by the United Nations due to the outpouring of support for Jews following the Nazi Holocaust in World War II. The return of the Jews to Israel-Palestine has been fraught with conflict ever since. Just think of all of the things that have taken place since the founding of that nation in 1948. There was the Arab-Israeli War. It actually started as a civil war during the waning period of the British Mandate. It became a full-fledged war after the establishment of Israel and ended with an armistice agreement in 1949 between Israel and Egypt, Jordan, Lebanon, and Syria. But that didn't stop the conflicts, as you are well aware. In the 1950s and 60s, there were various Palestinian insurgencies, attacks by Palestinians, and, of course, reprisals by Israel through their Israeli Defense Force, the IDF. Arab guerrillas would come in from outside of Palestine, from Syria and Egypt and Jordan, and cause a lot of these conflicts. And, of course, the Israelis would engage in some kind of response. There was, many of you perhaps remember, the Suez Crisis. I was too young to remember that. It took place in 1956, in which Britain and France and Israel attacked Egypt after Egypt decided to nationalize the Suez Canal and shut down shipping in the Straits of Tehran. And that certainly caused a number of significant issues. Eventually, in about 10 or 12 years later, the Six-Day War occurred. As continued tensions, as Egypt decided to close the Straits of Tehran again, and they massed the military assets along the border. Israel, on that occasion, countered, destroying a number of Egyptian assets, and the result was, in that war, Israel gained extensive territory. They gained the Golan Heights in the eastern section. They gained the West Bank, including East Jerusalem, as a result of the 67 war. They gained Gaza. Have you heard of Gaza, have you not? And they gained the Sinai. In 1973, there was the Yom Kippur War. The Arab states attacked Israel, seeking to recapture the territory that they lost in that Six-Day War back in 67. It was a surprise attack on the Jewish holiday. Israel repelled the attack and retained their territory. And I'm just skipping a lot of time here, a lot of more conflicts between Palestinians in southern Lebanon and in Gaza, various intifadas in the 80s and the 90s and the 2000s. You had the emergence of the PLO, Hezbollah, Hamas, all became key players in antagonism against this nation of Israel. That's just happened in the last, 50 or 60 years or so that Israel has been in existence. It's an extraordinary time, isn't it? To think about what these folks have gone through. This is significant for us, even as Christians, I believe. And the reason why it's significant to Christians is because many Bible-believing Christians believe that one of the key features of this time is the return of Israel to the land of Palestine. And that would eventually lead to the return of Christ and the end of time as we know it. That these are all significant historical events leading to the consummation of all time. John Walvoord has wrote back in a number of years ago of the many peculiar phenomena which characterize the present generation. Few events can claim equal significance as far as biblical prophecy is concerned with that of the return of Israel to their land. It constitutes a preparation for the end of the age, the setting for the coming of the Lord and His church, and the fulfillment of Israel's prophetic destiny. That was his view, the view of many, many others in the evangelical world. So the wars fought in the Middle East by Americans are simply more significant, I think, to Christians and to Jews, of course, than wars fought in, let's say, Grenada. Remember that episode? And other places around the world, even Ukraine. We're much more interested in this. Israel is the nation, as you are aware, most often mentioned in the Bible. What a surprise. But do you know what's second? Here's one of those questions like I threw out this morning, and I found that lots of people claimed that they knew the answer to this morning's question, but they were too shy to speak up. Anybody know what the second nation is that was mentioned, that's most mentioned in the Bible? It's Iraq. Now, we spent some time in Iraq, didn't we, as a nation? It's interesting, we're not there now, but Iraq is the second most named country in the Bible, nation in the Bible. Now, it's not called Iraq in the Bible. It's called Babylon. It's called the land of Shinar. It's called Chaldea. It's called Mesopotamia. The word Mesopotamia means between two rivers. It means between the Tigris and the Euphrates, which is in Iraq. The name Iraq means a country with deep roots. And the roots are deep indeed, even biblically. It's a country with deep roots with a significant history in the Bible. Eden was in Iraq, according to Genesis chapter 2. Adam and Eve were created in Iraq. Satan made his first recorded appearance in Iraq. The cradle of civilization was in Iraq, according to Genesis 4. Nimrod established Babylon, and the Tower of Babel was built in Iraq. The confusion of languages took place in Iraq. Abraham came from a city in Iraq, according to Genesis 11 and Acts chapter 7. Isaac's bride came from Iraq, according to Genesis 24. Jacob spent 20 years in Iraq, according to Genesis 27. And the first world empire was in Iraq, according to Daniel chapter 1 and 2. The greatest revival in history was in a city in Iraq, Jonah chapter 3. The events of the book of Esther took place in Iraq, in the book of Esther, and the book of Nahum was a prophecy against a city in Iraq. The book of Revelation has prophecies against Babylon, which was the old name for the nation of Iraq in Revelation 17 and 18. So no other nation except Israel has more history and prophecy associated with it than Iraq. Now, Iraq seems to be under the radar these days, and Iran seems to have emerged from its shadows, so essentially. But Iran, as the Persian area, certainly has a significant history in the Bible as well. So we find ourselves in an extraordinary time, but it seems like there has always been an extraordinary time in the Middle East. The location of the current fighting in Gaza has roots among peoples that had been displaced by Israel following their exodus from Egypt. It was occupied by the Canaanites and the Philistines. And then later on, that whole area was occupied by the Assyrians. And then after the Assyrians, the Greeks. Then after the Greeks, the Romans. And then there were the Seleucids of Syria and the Ptolemies of Egypt. And then there were the Hasmoneans. And so one civilization, one culture after another has run through that area over and over and over again. It's hard to imagine a period of time that has seen any more conflict than that region. We're going to try to understand a little bit about why that's the case. The reasons are complex yet simple. How's that for, a prevarication if there ever was one? It's complex but simple. It's complex in many levels. There are military dimensions to the conflicts. There are governmental dimensions to the conflicts. There are historical and diplomatic issues related. There are religious issues that certainly are infiltrated to all the different conflicts. There are personal and psychological aspects to the conflict. So the conflicts that have emerged in the Middle East have a great deal of complexity. But at another level, it's really quite simple. It's simple because of this. It's really all about the land. It's all about the land. It's not about our land here in the United States. It's not even really about Iraq or Afghanistan or Iran. It's all about the land of Palestine. At least that's what the Arab world calls it. But if you're a Jew, it's about the land of Israel. But one way or another, it's still about the land. And if you want to be objective about it, you might call it Israel-Palestine, with a slash in between, something like that. But whatever you want to call it, that's really what it's about. It's about that land. It's about something else as well. That something else is related to the land, comes from the land. It's important in the land. It's a resource. Now, if you mentioned this maybe 25 years ago, this might surprise you, because you actually don't hear much about it over here, but it certainly is a significant issue. When I mentioned that there's a resource in the land of the Middle East about which people are conflicted, most often people will say, well, it must be about oil. Actually, that's really false. I mean, I think President Bush was accused of this being his war with Iraq was all about oil. It really had nothing to do with oil. Certainly, oil money has supported so much of the insurrections and is still doing that now because of how the oil is being used by Iran and being marketed that way and supporting Hezbollah and Hamas. But that's another issue. The second thing that the conflicts have always been about is about water. So it's about land, but it's also about water. Because you see, water is extraordinarily important to the land, as it turns out. As you can well imagine why. The crisis concerning the land has a lot to do with water. But of course, water is a part of the land. The crisis is all about the land. A day doesn't go by when we don't think about what's happening over there in the land. We all have opinions about it. We have sometimes very strong convictions about it, convictions that many Christians believe are driven by biblical concerns, but it really is about the land. The Bible has its characterizations about this land, which are quite remarkable. Let's list a few of them. In Ezekiel chapter 20, verse 6, we read, "On that day I swore to them that I would bring them out of the land of Egypt into a land that I had searched out for them, a land flowing with milk and honey, the most glorious of all lands." The NIV in that passage calls it the most beautiful of all lands. Deuteronomy chapter 8, verses 7 to 9 says, "For the Lord your God is bringing you into a good land, a land of brooks of water, of fountains and springs, flowing out in the valleys and hills, a land of wheat and barley, of vines and fig trees and pomegranates, a land of olive trees and honey, a land in which you will eat bread without scarcity, in which you will lack nothing, a land whose stones are iron and out of whose hills you can dig copper." So you had not only the agricultural produce emerging from the land, but you also had the mineral resources as well. Daniel chapter 8 and 11 call it the beautiful land. Other translations of that passage call it the glorious land or the pleasant land. Malachi 3:12 says, "Then all nations will call you blessed, for you will be a land of delight, says the Lord of hosts." And Jeremiah 3:19 says, "I said, how I would set you among my sons and give you a pleasant land, a heritage most beautiful of all nations. And I thought you would call me my father and would not turn from following me." So the Bible really characterizes this land about which the conflicts emerge in glorious ways and enticing ways and ways that are quite inviting. And it's not terribly surprising then that it might be the source of conflict. Let me give you some general impressions about the land. There are a number of us who went there just a couple of years ago and enjoyed that very much. But the first general impression that I would have is how small it is. It's unbelievably small when you think about it. About 150 miles long, about 50 miles wide. Imagine the country only 50 miles wide. It's about the size of New Jersey. And it's also not only small, but incredibly diverse within that particular small geographical area. It has mountains which are nearly twice as high as any in the Mountain State, my beloved West Virginia. It has a depression which is the lowest place on earth. It has Mediterranean beaches on the west. It has an Arabian desert on the east. It has lush valleys in the north. It has dry mountainous wilderness in the south. Almost every conceivable kind of terrain can be imagined. If you think about the land and how it unfolds from north to south, you might begin in the north with the Galilee. That's centered around a large lake called the Sea of Galilee. Sea is a term that's probably a bit extravagant for actually what it is. It's only 13 miles wide and 8 miles long. It seems small, but it's surrounded by a ridge of mountains that create a unique bowl, and the mountains around it can be some 1,000 feet above sea level, but the lake is 650 feet below sea level. And when the winds sweep down from these mountains, they can create turbulent storms on the sea and change from a glass-like placid water to waves that can capsize fishing boats. And from the sea to the west, the mountains rise and continue to the Mediterranean Sea, terminating at Haifa. I think there's probably pictures of some of that kind of thing as well that Luis is able to show you, or the staff is able to show you up there. To the north rise even greater mountains, eventually rising to Mount Hermon. Mount Hermon is more than 9,000 feet above sea level. It's snow-covered most of the year at some point. There's an incredible ascent from 650 feet below sea level at the Sea of Galilee up to Mount Hermon in something less than 50 miles. Incredible. Mount Hermon is snow-covered, as I mentioned. It's shared by Israel and also Syria and Lebanon. It's legendary in the Bible. You have Psalm 133, which says, "It is like the dew of Hermon, which falls on the mountains of Zion, for there the Lord has commanded the blessing, life forevermore." And so the headwaters of the Jordan River come and flow from that region, flow into the Sea of Galilee, and those waters flow into the Hule Valley, which is a rich and well-watered farmland, able to grow lots of different kinds of crops. East of Hermon is the Golan Heights Plateau that receives just enough rainfall to produce cereal crops. And before the 1967 war, it belonged to Syria. It's strategically important as it looks over the valley below. The Syrians would use it to terrorize farmers in the kibbutzes below by lobbing mortars into their farms. One of the main points of contention as Israel holds onto the Golan Heights for security reasons and has tried to negotiate and navigate those waters since then, a lot of villages had been settled there, especially with Russian Jews in the last several decades. There's an important trade route that has existed since the ancient world through this region. And from the Golan down into the valley below to the sea, to the Galilean Sea at Capernaum, there's an Old Testament fortress called Hazor, which is located near the head of this valley, and that's the current site of a large archaeological dig. Capernaum was also extremely important in Jesus' ministry, as you know. Some New Testament elements testify of its role on this trade route. That became a station for taxation, which explains why Matthew, the tax collector, was found there. A Roman garrison with its centurion was also stationed there, according to Matthew chapter 8. And that trade route made Galilee the place of contact with many nations and peoples as they passed through that region. We read in chapter 4 of Matthew these things. When he heard that John had been arrested, that is, Jesus withdrew into Galilee, and leaving Nazareth, he went and lived in Capernaum by the sea in the territory of Zebulun and Naphtali, so that what was spoken by the prophet Isaiah might be fulfilled. The land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali, the way of the sea beyond the Jordan, Galilee of the Gentiles. The people dwelling in darkness have seen a great light, and for those dwelling in the region and shadow of death, on them a light has dawned. So even from the beginning of Jesus' ministry, he was putting himself in a place where the nations would pass by, foreshadowing his ultimate mission that he would give to his church, that is, the taking of the gospel to the ends of the earth. Also important strategically in the region of the Sea of Galilee was the source of much of the Palestinians' water supply. National water carrier begins there and runs the length of the country and supplies cities like Tel Aviv on the Mediterranean coast. And so water from Galilee has been heavily contested, heavily protected, regulated by the Israelis and its outflow, as well as the waters that feed it. And that has been a great source of contention with the Palestinians. In recent years, Israel has developed one of the most extensive desalinization operations in the world and now uses a great deal of water from the Mediterranean. So that issue of water seems to have taken a little bit more of a back seat in terms of the conflicts. That's the region of the Galilee. The Jezreel is next. The Galilee is bordered on the south by the Jezreel Valley, runs all the way from the Jordan to the Mediterranean. That has been the site of many wars historically during the period of the Judges and the early kingdom periods. An army with chariots could control the valley and could cut Israel in half. And that's why Deborah chose to confront the chariots of Yabin, the king of Hazor in Galilee, from Mount Tabor. Saul fought many battles there, and Saul died there, along with Jonathan, his son. Number of wars here make it legendary for the location of the final conflict, which, depending on your theology, could be the site of the actual final battle preceding the return of Christ, what we know of as the Valley of Armageddon. Megiddo is a fortress in the mountainous area in the southwest of the valley. Har means mountains of, and so Armageddon, it means the mountains of Megiddo. And the valley is the valley below the mountains of Megiddo. So currently that valley is a rich agricultural asset. It has generous rainfall, unsurpassed fertility, and the Israelis take great advantage of it. Moving further south, you have the Central Mountains and the Jordan Valley. The Central Mountains range from north to south parallel to the Jordan River, rising to about 2,600 feet near Jerusalem, more than 3,000 feet near Shechem and Hebron. And to the Jews, the northern part of this area was called Samaria and the south Judea. To the Palestinians, it's known as the West Bank. Cities like Jerusalem, which is relatively remote from the trade routes, that is the routes of the Egyptian and Mesopotamian armies, which would usually stay along the coast, nevertheless became a significant site in those regions. The west side of the range, the low rolling hills, are called the Shephelah. These are fertile hills with generous rainfall. They are a highly valued region and have been the sites of lots of conflicts between Israelis and Palestinians, usually over this land. The tendency of Israel over the years was to move west to acquire these lands, and the tendency of the Palestinian, excuse me, the Philistines was to resist them. Since the 1948 and 67 era, many Arab villages were destroyed in this region, and new Israeli towns have appeared in their place. The Shephelah gradually descends to a coastal plain until it reaches the Mediterranean Sea, where you have cities like Caesarea and Joppa and modern Tel Aviv. The eastern side of that range of hills produces a severe descent into the Jordan Valley and eventually the Dead Sea. The desert receives maybe 5 to 10 inches of rain each year. The Judean wilderness was the site of Jesus' temptation. Joshua's entrance into Jericho took place in that region. And then after that, would climb 3,700 feet in about 15 miles to get from Jericho to the area around Jerusalem and Hebron. In the Jordan Valley, we find the lowest place on earth. The Jordan River ends at the Dead Sea, which is 1,275 feet below sea level. It doesn't have any outflow. It accumulates salt and no life, essentially. It has become a productive outlet, however, for the cosmetic industry, but it is also losing water, as a result, losing resources, and so it's diminishing in the quantity of water that is in the Dead Sea. In the north end of the Dead Sea, you have the Oasis of Jericho. Herod also built a great winter palace there, which is about the only time you'd really want to live there, I would think. And then an important archaeological site in this region is Qumran, which was the site of the finding of the Dead Sea Scrolls among the caves there, which had been inhabited by the Essenes. And then Masada, a great fortress built by the Romans, is not far away. And that was eventually defended by the Jews as they overtook it in the last struggle against Rome toward the end of the first century. East of the Jordan Valley, you have the mountains of Moab and Edom, which climbs quickly to a plateau of about 3,000 feet. That's the location of a desert highway. And that was a highway used by Moses and the Israelites in their journey to the Promised Land, and that section belongs to Jordan today. And then finally, in the south, you have the Negev deserts. The Jordan Valley is essentially, at this point, waterless. It's actually a geological rift which extends all the way to the Nile Valley. And anyone living there needs some natural springs. And so you have places like Beersheba. And Beersheba means seven springs. That's why there are people there. The natives in that area are Bedouins who wander around with their livestock and eat rocks. At least that's the only thing I can see that they could eat. They must be eating something else, but that's what it just appears to be. It's amazing how they even exist. We need to mention the neighbors. In the north, you have Lebanon, which has had its own share of civil unrest. You have the northeast, you have Syria, and the west, you have Jordan. All of those nations have precarious relations with Israel. They all depend upon who is in power at one point in time or another. All of those have received numerous refugees. Arabs who have fled from Palestine since 1948 as a result of the wars have ended up in one or another of those places, and many of them in the United States. Now refugees fleeing from Syria as a result of their troubles have gone into Jordan as well as Lebanon and even Iraq. That's a little about the geography of the land. And there's a lot more that we could share about that, but I don't think we can understand the issues without at least that much of an introduction to the lay of the land. It's quite a remarkable place. But the question that I'm left with is, why did God choose this land? Certainly there's much beauty in the land. And while certain agricultural regions are prosperous, there are other, even more fertile areas around the world that God could have chosen. And while the climate in many respects is appealing, there are other, even more appealing climates, maybe even like this one. Certainly there are some extremely desolate and forbidding areas in this land as well. So you might wonder, why did God choose this land? Did God just pick this region out of a hat to place his chosen people? This is one of the most neglected questions, I think, that surround the history and geography of this place. I think the answer is that we need to go all the way back to God's covenant with Abraham. In that covenant, we go back and recognize that in the early days, we find the roots of what has caused the biblical crisis today. In Genesis chapter 12, a passage that we looked at last week, we read, "Now the Lord said to Abram, 'Go from your country and your kindred and your father's house to the land I will show you, and I will make of you a great nation, and I will bless you and make your name great, so that you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and him who dishonors you I will curse.'" And then we read this, "And in you all the families of the earth will be blessed." All the families of the earth will be blessed. Not only will Abram be a great nation, he will be a blessing. "And in him all the families of the earth will be blessed." The NIV in that passage says, "all the peoples of the earth." Peoples is ethne in the Greek translation of that Old Testament passage. That is, all the people who are separated by culture and language and that sort of thing. That's a strange statement to make to someone who was to be given a specific strip of land the size of New Jersey. Just think about that. How would all the families of the earth be blessed by God establishing a nation in New Jersey? Or Palestine, for that matter. Well, the covenant that God established would make Abraham and his descendants a blessing to all peoples and all nations. Well, how can this be? Well, when you back up and see the land for how it relates to the rest of the world, the answer, I think, becomes clear. Already mentioned have been the trade routes that passed through this area. And all the routes of the conquering armies that have gone through this region over the millennia. We have the routes that were called the Via Maris, or the Way of the Sea, and you had other places. And so basically what you discover is that Israel-Palestine is actually a land bridge that connects three major continents. It's a land bridge that connects three major continents. Abraham could be a blessing to many nations because this was the most fortuitous location for the spread of the gospel all across the world. As the apostles were dispersed, they carried the gospel south to Egypt, which at that time was called Cush, and even further south. There are Christian churches there today that date from the first century. They carried it east through Central Asia, all the way to India. They carried it north and west to Europe, and from Europe it spread to North America, and from Europe and North America it spread to South America, and from North America then it came back to Africa, and from North America even to East Asia in the last couple hundred years. And so, dear friends, I would submit to you that there was no greater location in all of the earth to facilitate the blessing of Abraham to all nations. This was a place where you could get from everywhere. We used to say when people were looking for directions up in the mountainous part of West Virginia, and someone would stop and say, how do I get to this place? Oh, you can't get there from here, would be the answer. No, in this place, you could get to everywhere eventually, because this is a land bridge that connected all of the continents. And remember, it's also the place from which all the peoples of the earth were dispersed at the time of Babel. And so to get all of those people back, this was the location that God gave to Abraham in order to be a blessing to many nations. That, I think, is the ultimate answer for why God chose this land and why the land has been in an uproar ever since. We need to say a few words about Christians and the land, because I think that's something that ought to be recognized about how Christians have viewed this land. We first of all need to ask the question about Israel and the covenant. Obviously, Israel had some covenant responsibilities. We looked at a lot of those last week when we examined the scriptures. The big question that hangs over us today, I think, is the nation of Israel that exists over in Israel-Palestine functioning in fulfillment of the covenant? That's a tough question to answer. I'm not going to pose that like I posed the question this morning, because that question this morning was an easy one. This is a difficult question. Is Israel functioning in fulfillment of that covenant? Remember, the land is part of the covenant, and so is the blessing. Is the blessing of God flowing through Israel to all peoples? And we're going to come back to that question over and over again in the subsequent sessions that we have. But it's an important question to consider. It's no slam dunk, by the way. Is Israel functioning in fulfillment of their covenant responsibilities? The approaches that Christians have taken into the land fit into a number of different categories. I'll lay them out for you, and then you can sort of see which ones seem to resonate with you. One of the approaches to the land was the Crusader approach. Over the course of several hundred years from the fall of the Roman Empire, various armies have sought to conquer and control the land, and the land fell under the growing influence during that period of time of Islam. And yet in Europe, the land was regarded as the Holy Land. And as such, Christians in those days, who regarded themselves as the true spiritual Israel at the time, could hardly bear the thought that the area would remain under Muslim control. That was the overall spiritual or religious motivation for the Crusades, which, to oversimplify, was an attempt by human means and the power of the sword to establish a godly kingdom. And that is a misguided effort if there ever was one. The land still bears evidences of the Crusader conflicts. You can see ruins from the Crusader period. And even those days are a millennium behind us, I can tell you that the Arab Muslim mind still recalls them as if they were yesterday. You can rest assured, by the way, that the ministry of Campus Crusade for Christ in the Middle East is not called Campus Crusade for Christ. In fact, it's not even called CRU, which is what Crusade has become here in the States. It's called Agape. The last thing Crusade wants you to know when they go to the Middle East is to evoke memories among Muslims of while they understand the Crusader period of time. Another approach that Christians have taken is the pilgrim approach. The failure of the Crusades has not diminished our thinking of the land as the Holy Land. Even though Christians haven't controlled the area for centuries, many have at least ventured to go there seeking the blessing of walking where Jesus walked. And there was supposed to be something about the land that was necessary even as a spiritual experience. You can still see pilgrims today entering various holy sites with extraordinary veneration of what they are seeing. I'm inclined to think that's also been a misguided approach, at least in some measure. Jesus himself taught the woman at the well that there would be no special virtue in a place of worship as there had been in the past. Worship could and would take place in every corner of the globe in spirit and in truth. And the Bible offers no specific blessings for Christians to go back and tie themselves to that place. Now, I think we should all go there. If you haven't already, it's a fascinating place to visit. Much learning can take place where we see the geography, see the artifacts of the early church, see the remnants of the history there, but not so much as pilgrims who go there to venerate sites. The Zionist approach is another approach in which it's always been a desire of the Jew to return to the land. Prophets spoke frequently about such a return, particularly in the context of the Babylonian exile, and the Jews did return there under Cyrus to the land following a generation in Babylon. But when they returned after Babylon, only about 50,000 returned, and that's a far cry from the million or so that Moses led out of Egypt. When they returned, they found Jerusalem destroyed, they found the temple ruined. They engaged in rebuilding, both under Ezra and Nehemiah, but the rebuilding never approached the glory of the city under Solomon. And even under their return, the Jews were constantly under the oppressive arm of other nations. The Persians under Cyrus, the Greeks under Alexander, and of course, eventually the Romans. And it was a cause for great distress. It was also a cause for a hope for something more. What did the prophets mean by their predictions of experiencing the glory of the promised land once again? Was it merely a figure of heaven drawing on the glories of the earthly to teach what might await the true believer in the glories of heaven? Or did those predictions actually have in mind the establishment of another earthly Israel, a restoration of the land and its pleasures and delights to God's chosen people? The Zionist approach is the latter view. And so following World War II and the aftermath of the Nazi Holocaust, this powerful support for a homeland for the Jewish people was evident in Europe and in America. And under the sanction of the United Nations, the modern state of Israel was established. And Jews who had already started to return little by little since the 19th century came back in droves. But it took more than a UN declaration to establish the state. It took war. War which the Zionist Israelis had been training for in Palestine since the 1930s. We'll talk more about that in a subsequent session. The establishment of the State of Israel in 1948 has fueled those Zionists' hopes, hopes which are very evident in Israel even today and in Jews around the world, hopes which hinge on the land promises in the covenant, hopes which assume the right ownership of the land by the Jewish people in spite of who has occupied the land in the last 2,000 years. The question that we need to explore a little bit is, does Zionism truly represent the biblical approach to the land? And we'll explore that question. Then there is the millennial approach. This is sort of the Christian version of Zionism. It's based upon a category of theology called dispensationalism, and that regards God's program for Israel as distinct and different from God's program for the church. Israel and the church are two different entities, although they have some relationship to each other. And that allows Christians to sort of compartmentalize what God is doing in Israel-Palestine from what God is doing in the church throughout the rest of the world. So Israel and the church seem to be separate entities according to that theology. According to that theology, Christians see the return of the Jews to the land in spite of their rejection as Messiah up to this point in time as fulfillment of the prophetic promises regarding the land. I gave you the quote from Dr. Walvoord earlier this evening. And so that allows Christians to, from a political perspective, to support Israel, whether or not Israel would act the way Jesus, the Messiah, taught that the church should act. So that's one of the questions we need to wrestle with. That's driven by a theology that sees the church being removed from the earth, by the way, prior to a Jewish tribulation in the land, in preparation for the battle to end all battles, just before the return of Christ to establish his earthly millennial kingdom, as seems to be described in Revelation 20. Now, the millennial perspective has become essentially sort of the majority report among evangelicals in the United States, especially in the last 150 years. But I don't think it's the majority report among Christians almost every place else in the world. And I can tell you that it's not the majority report among Christian Arabs living in Palestine. What? Christian Arabs living in Palestine? Is there such a creature? Yes, there is. There have been many more in previous generations, but yes, there are still Christian Arabs living in Palestine. They would dispute that kind of approach to understanding the land. We're going to examine some of those issues. The last approach that Christians have taken to the land might be called the renewal approach, and that the land at the height of its glory is seen as a taste and a foreshadow of the restoration, not of an earthly kingdom, but of the new heavens and the new earth. There is the hope of a return to the land, but a land that is far surpassing whatever could be experienced in Israel-Palestine, a land much larger, far more glorious than anything Solomon could have had in his wildest imaginations, a land which includes believers of every race and people and tongue, both Jew and Gentile, who are all together in one body called the Church of Jesus Christ. That seemed to be the majority understanding of the church for most of the 2,000 years of church history, but it seems to have taken a back seat in recent generations. Well, that's a little bit about the summary. We'll sort of explore questions. We'll not answer every question, by the way, and we'll probably raise more questions than we'll answer, and we'll not always agree about everything that is mentioned, but we'll try to understand what underlies this kind of crisis. Certainly it's complicated, but in one sense, it's simple. It's about the land. More than anything else, we want to seek to understand what our responsibilities might be. We can't avoid dealing with that issue. We're already involved, by the way, because billions of your tax dollars go to Israel today. In fact, billions more today than did 2 days ago. I don't know if you keep up with the news. So that seems moving through Congress quite rapidly as in the last couple of days. The United States has been known to militarily support nations on every side of the conflict. So it's kind of interesting to see how conflicted it might be. But if you're an American citizen, you're involved. And if you're Christian, you're very interested. And that's what this series is about. Heavenly Father, give us the grace to be able to work through these kinds of issues, recognizing that in the midst of the chaos in this world, nevertheless, you are working all things together for good for those who love you and are called according to your purpose, and that you are bringing history to its appointed conclusion, and that you'll accomplish your purposes in the end in ways that will glorify you and extend your kingdom. And we look forward to those days in which we can taste the kingdom of God in its fullness. And we'll look forward to how you accomplish that. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.